Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour for January 14th, 2021, kicking off this year with a, I don't know if it's a thud or a dud or a, anyway, what we have to do though is look forward and when diversity hits, just take a positive attitude and move forward. There are some good things that are coming out of what's happening, and that is, for one, the dependency on government. Government is not going to solve your problems, whether it's education, whether it's taking care of the environment, whether it's balancing, healthcare, whatever it is, government cannot do the job. Their belief is that, yes, they can, and they're the all-overseeing eye that will take care of all of your problems. All you got to do is just sit back and relax. So I'm going to talk about the real price of electricity tonight, something that's very important, and then some other incidentals, like there's an interesting little calculation I'm going to do regarding the Christmas star. But not so much the Christmas star, but the three wise men. Little insight into that. And then there's some new rock paintings that were discovered in the Amazon. And I think they look a little bit too fresh to be 12,000 years old. But it is, especially in the Amazon, where everything gets, let's take an example. When the Stevens and Catherwood discovered the Mayan ruins down in Yucatan and Belize and that area. When they discovered the Mayan ruins, they had only been there for what? From about 800, estimated 800 AD, up to around the 1800. So that's about 1,000 years. And they were completely overgrown. Roots had gotten in, to the point where they actually moved the rock covering off the pyramids and the edifices, the buildings, and then they were rebuilt. So what you see when you go back today has been completely rebuilt. That's not what it was like. You can see the original Catherwood prints of his drawings, and he was a magical artist that could just bring life out of those ruins in the jungle. But for you to believe that these rock paintings done with some kind of red paint that probably came from a plant or something, or an insect, whatever they were using. To imagine that those things have weathered in the Amazon for 12,000 years and are just pristine, just like the day the guy drew them down, I don't know. Anyway, I'll be talking a little bit about that. And then also, very interesting, the talk show live annual ratings have come out for talk show hosts. And this is very interesting, it's at least from my perspective, because number 43 on there was Daniel Brigman in the Power Hour, where I'm a regular guest. And I was on there yesterday, my regular second Wednesday of the month appearance on that show. And I know that, well, Daniel tells me I'm his favorite guest. He'll actually say that on the air. And he'll tell me that off the air. And that's probably not good policy to say things like that. But anyway, he said it. And that's good. But I know when I'm on radio shows, I get big response. In fact, there are radio shows that call me up to do an interview on ratings night specifically. And that's been going on for a long time. Because people tune in when I'm the guest. At any rate, I'll talk about that a little bit as it's just one of the other topics. And maybe I should start out with this topic because a listener that listens to me on WWCR shortwave called into the station and said, gee, it's just really hard to get a hold of me. But they didn't have internet. So on my internet webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage, there's a link there, just standard procedure on any webpage today. There's a contact or about. One of those two is what you look for on the webpage headings. And I have right up at the very top, there's a contact button. And on there, is an email address. And there's no phone because I just really don't have people to sit around and answer the phone all day. And I felt a little bad because the guy wanted to order a water filter with a check. And I used to take checks, but let me just preface this by saying, you know, in terms of age, I would be considered elderly in most circles. If you put me in most groups in the country, the groups are groups of interest, I would probably be the oldest person there in a lot of cases, or certainly amongst the elderly class. And I do very well because I maintain my health by good food, clean water, no chemicals, I probably don't get as much exercise as I should because I'm glued to my chair doing all of the different things that I do. But I try and maintain my weight down, a sufficient amount of exercise, not a lot of sugar in the diet. And, you know, I'm not a health freak by any means. But also when I was young, I was very active, like camping and carrying my backpack and canoe and eating fresh fish out of the lake, etc. So, you know, those things carry over into later life, you know, exercise. But here's my point. I'm really, really busy, and I feel a little bit bad because people call up and they want to chat. You know, they want to talk to me. And like today and yesterday, the last few days, I've been really, really busy. There are people who are a little put off because they invite me to go. They say, come on, we could go up and there's some entertainment around here, or there's some, you know, nice park places to go to nearby, and you come up and visit with us. And I say, well, you know, I'm kind of busy. But I really am busy, you know, doing the stuff that has to get done. And then finding a few hours out of the week to relax and just be a normal person. But so I just want to say that, you know, most people my age have retired into golfing or sitting around maybe writing their memoirs at best. That's not me. I'm busy. I have the product lines to keep up and the customer, you know, they always have customer interaction, you know, about products people have purchased, etc. And so I don't want people to feel bad and accuse me of being hard to get a hold of. There is an email address available on the webpage, and I don't accept mail order orders anymore. And so there's a lot of things I'm trying to streamline my business so that I can manage all of these things. If I'm seem to be aloof and hard to get a hold of and things like that, it's in a sense a little bit by design, but please understand that it's not because I don't like people or trying to stand off away from people. It's just that very simply I am really, really busy. And so that's the bottom line. Okay, enough of that. This past week, England had just a skyrocket in the price of electricity. Now, to give you an idea, commercial electricity is sold in megawatt hours. Like when you get your electric bill at home, you have kWh, little k, big W, little h. That's kilowatt hours. That's the unit of energy. And if you look on your bill, they will tell you how much you pay for a kilowatt hour. It's usually around 10 cents or $0.10 or $0.17, somewhere in that range. Some people might be a bit higher, etc. But that's typically what you range. But anyway, wholesale electricity is sold in terms of megawatt hours. And typically, that's around, say, $80 a megawatt hour, okay? $80, 80. In England this past week, and I'll explain why this happened, the rate for megawatt hour of electricity went up to $2,242. So about let's say $2,200 per megawatt hour, when it's typically $80. In England, it might be a little bit more, but that's the wholesale cost. And so, hundreds of times more than what it should be, literally, and this spiked overnight. And the reason is that they have invested in three-blade wind turbines and solar. And so they're expecting this input to come in from those two sources of what they call alternative energy. And at that point, they were not producing when they had a high demand because, of course, they're in the middle of winter. And even though they don't have a lot of cold, the British Isles are warmed by that Gulf Stream, etc., and the being close to the ocean. But imagine that. Imagine that it went up from $80 to $2,200 overnight. And now all these people are going to have to pay this. This is not free. And the reason is because they invested in three-blade wind turbines, which don't work. Anyway, this is causing problems in the wind industry because it's really strange to watch this go on because you see the power companies investing in this. You have Joe Biden and the Democrats and the global climate change people going, oh, we got to invest trillions of dollars into alternative energy. The bottom line, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, grandmas and grandpas and everybody else, kids and little boys and girls, the alternative energy that's been presented, the three-blade wind turbines and the solar panels, simply do not work. And this is what you're going to see. You're going to put in trillions of dollars worth of this stuff, and it's not going to work. And this is why I criticize, for example, public education, because people are not taught to think. They're taught to think with emotion. Oh, we have to save the planet, and if we invest all this money, the politicians say that, you know, nobody has a clue that what they're thinking of doing ain't going to work. It's not going to work. It's the economy cannot run on three-blade wind turbine power. It cannot run on solar power. Neither one of them will work. The wing generator, that's why I designed it, is to cover those, to actually solve the world energy problems. So the main reason I'm pointing this out is because the plan, the Green New Deal or whatever, simply is not going to work. And as I said, education has turned people into fact repeaters. And so if whatever they're told, if that's told as a fact by somebody in authority, the people's mindset, because of the education system in the United States, is to not question that. Oh, okay, you need a vaccine. You have to invest $8 trillion into something that doesn't work. You have to, anyway, I'm not going to go and list all the other things here, but understand that the Green New Deal simply will not work. This is something that is, I believe, somewhat of a travesty, and I'm going to say this on the air. It's my opinion, but the Ohio State football game, they played Alabama, world-class, certainly world champion college football team, and probably was certainly the favorite, etc. But Ohio State was matching them play for play, pretty much. And then all of a sudden, you could see coaching calls that were being made, both offense and defense, for Ohio State that completely did not make any sense at all. And I played football in high school. I'm not an expert. But how many times do you run the football up the gut for a two-yard gain, knowing that Alabama's defense is going to stop you every time? In a championship game, you have to come out with blowout offense. You have to come out with complete containment defense. So you don't run stunts to one side, leaving the entire other side of the field open, completely open. That would be, say, freshman in high school, very inexperienced coach might do something like that. not world-class national championship quality coaching. And so I'm simply going to say it, if you're an Ohio State fan or not, or a fan of college football, or just a fan of sports in general, my opinion is, after looking at that, is that the coaches threw the game through bad coaching. Not bad coaching, but deliberate bad coaching, because either they were really stupid or they threw the game on purpose. That's the only conclusion I can come to. And the reason I'm putting this on the air, I typically don't talk about sports, but in the world we live in today, the amount of betting and investment that goes on in these games, if someone were betting locally against Ohio State, they would certainly want to make sure, if they were corrupt people, let's put it that way, which there's certainly plenty of them, they would want to make sure that Ohio State lost. And it looked like when there was actual play going on, that Ohio State was matching them on defense and offense. At one point, Ohio State had half as many yards, but it was a tie game still, maybe 14-14 early in the game. But Ohio State had half as many yards, but had equaled them in score, the Alabama score. Anyway, I think it's worth mentioning because it was just too blatant to not notice. On to the Christmas star. Now, like I said, this is not so much about the Christmas star, a little bit, but also about the three wise men. So I sat down and I did some calculations, something that I don't think anybody who has really done, at least I've never seen this, and talked about how far did these guys have to travel. And so they're always made up, and apparently this is historically accurate. The three wise men came from countries to the east. Clearly, that's true. So I picked three countries, and these are hypothetical. These are arbitrary. I picked Iran, Syria, and Arabia. And back in the days of the Roman Empire, around the year zero, those would have been about 1,000 miles away. Now, one or two of them may have been a bit farther away. So I'm going to give this example either for a 1,000-mile trip or a 2,000-mile trip. Now, let's take the preparation time for this trip. So they see the star, the three wise men. They look up in the sky. Independently, they look up and they see the star. And this is the star that they've been waiting for thousands of years. It's not a planetary alignment. Don't let anybody pull that one over on you. It's I believe, a very unusual comet, potentially a triple nucleus comet that would have very specific characteristics that would be able to, when you look at that, it's like, no, there ain't no other comet like that one. That's it. That's the Messiah comet. And that's an estimate. There are other things that the Christmas star could have been. But anyway, be that as it may, they discover it in the east. They go, that's it, independently. They pack their bags. Now, packing your bags to go on a camel trip that's going to take 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles, you got to pack everything with you because there's nothing along the way. There's not your kind of food along the way. There's no hamburger stands. There's no, you have to take everything. You have to take your entourage. You have to take all the food for them, all the supplies, charcoal for cooking. This is a big operation, each one of these guys. Plus, you're bringing your best robe, because when you finally get to the Messiah location, you're going to be dressed up regally and presenting your gift to the new king. Okay, so I would give them 25 days to prepare this trip. It's not like they were all ready. It's not like they had their bags all packed, because people had been waiting for thousands of years for this. Remember, this is from the Old Testament. This is from the pact that God had with Abraham back in the, and back going back to even before that, but to send a Messiah. And so I would say 25 days to prepare. Okay, now a camel train, is what they were riding on. There were no Mercedes-Benz. There were no Porsches. No superhighways. A camel train averages about 25 miles per day. And so if it was 40, if it was a 1,000-mile distance, which it would be from the three places I picked, it would be about a 40-day journey to cover that 1,000 miles, following the star to the west. Because remember, they discovered it in the east, they followed it to the west. Very typical of a comet. Okay, now, and very atypical, not typical at all, of a planetary alignment. By the way, one of the other many, many reasons that you would know that the Christmas star was not a planetary alignment. Planetary alignments only last for a few days. They had to follow this baby for at least a month. It had to be up in the sky visible for minimally 3 months, probably much longer, possibly up to a year or more. So now if they were 2,000 miles away, it would have taken them 80 days, close to 3 months. So the 40 days, 1,000-mile trip, more than a month, plus another 25-day preparation times 2 months. So minimal time to pack, get yourself going, and get across the desert to discover the Messiah, 2 months, maybe 4 months or more. But here's the clincher, that Mary was already pregnant, but possibly not even showing yet when they had to determine this star and then pack the bags and start moving. This is something I don't think anybody really has talked about before, and the fact that the Christmas star had to be present as they followed it to the west. And then there is the very intriguing question of, once the Christmas star, it is said to come to rest over the manger, the little animal hut where Jesus was born. And so what exactly was going on up in the sky with this comet or whatever it was? I believe it was a comet, but, you know, a star with a tail on it, very special star. But how could it come to rest over the stable? And if you remember, these wise men were astrologers. So I'm not going to try and second guess what their measurement was, what their criteria, what their criteria was for determining that the star had come to rest at a certain place. It may have been something as simple as at midnight. And so, like at midnight, the star would be in the west. So obviously they had not come to the correct location yet. And so they keep going west. Every night the star is higher and higher in the sky. And finally, at the count of midnight, they look straight up and there's the star perfectly above. And they look in the distance and there's the little manger. And shining, this was so bright that it actually cast light onto the ground. And so it was like, not like daylight, but like a full moon, that much light was available. And so then and that's just a potential scenario. I'm just giving that as a type of scenario that the wise men, being astrologers, would have had access to. It was something that they would have predetermined. And remember, they visited Herod along the way. So, I mean, this was a long trip. And I estimate that, okay, minimally it would have taken 40 to 80 days. Potentially it could have taken up to a year, which means that they started moving before Mary was even pregnant. If you can wrap your brain around that one, that is potentially true. So anyway, we don't have a lot of data to go on, but you can surmise certain things because of all of the information given. Quickly on to the next topic. There's a 12,000-year-old rock painting. It's on the side of a rock. It's fairly extensive, and it looks like a lot of other rock paintings of indigenous people, rock paintings that you would discover, say, in the American Southwest or other places around the world. And it shows the people, with mastodons, big animals. And then what the archaeologists do is they go, oh, well, that had to be 10 or 12,000 years ago, because that's when the mastodons lived. But the reality is that mastodons lived up to about 4,000 years ago, and that's well known, although that's not what you will see in the textbooks. Once again, very poor education, where one of the things is timing and the history of man is totally distorted in the history books, especially those history books given to kids. So the end result is that this rock painting, number one, because of its pristine condition, could not be 12,000 years old. And probably it would have been totally defaced and overgrown. Now remember, this is in the Amazon jungle where this was discovered. And so even imagining that it was 4,000 years old at the upper edge of the period of time when the mastodons were still roaming Earth. And this is what Velikovsky was saying, by the way, was that the time frame for that transition from the mastodon, the saber-toothed tiger, and those, the big giant sloth, etc., those animals were still living on Earth around 4,000 years ago. But modern science immediately classifies this as 12,000 years ago, out of sight, out of mind, out of time frame that would be normally much closer to what we're looking at today. Next topic, nuclear is now classified as an alternative source of energy. How absolutely absurd. And so what I'm going to do here is read what are considered to be alternative energy sources and explain to you why none of these are. The only true source of alternative energy, which is a true renewable source of energy, is the wind. It's the best, and it's the only one that's going to be used to solve the world energy problem. But let me just go through these. One of them is hydrogen gas. And they make it sound like, oh, just hydrogen gas. Hey, everybody's got a tank of that sitting around, don't they? Hydrogen gas comes from a number of sources. You take a chemical process and you remove the hydrogen from some chemical, and one of the more common ones is water. Water is H2O, and so you have that hydrogen, a pair of hydrogen, which is literally the hydrogen molecule and a single oxygen atom. That's water, clearly abundant source of water on planet Earth. The whole oceans, etc., even though it's salt water. But you can take water, you can split it, and hydrogen can be used in a number of ways. Hydrogen can be used for fusion, or it can be returned with oxygen to burn as a cell, battery cell type of scenario. So there's a couple different ways to use hydrogen. But make it very clear, hydrogen is not a renewable source of energy. Why is it not? Number one is that no matter what you do with it, whether you return it to oxygen or whether you return it in the form of nuclear fusion, it gives off heat. Any process that takes an inert material and converts it into heat, where you take that heat and then, say, create water into steam and steam drives turbines, etc., anything that creates heat is not alternative energy, just by its very definition, because heat is a byproduct that has to go into the atmosphere, and direct heating is much worse than alleged greenhouse heating. So is hydrogen gas a renewable source of energy? No. How are you going to split the hydrogen off of this other chemical or out of water? That takes energy. And so in that sense, you're using hydrogen more like a battery to store energy. It's more like storing energy than being an original energy source itself. Hydrogen is not just laying around to pick up. You don't go out with a shovel, or you don't go out with an air pump and pump hydrogen into a tank out of the air. Hydrogen has to be created. by chemical separation or some process like that. So, and then when you burn it, it gives off 70%+ in the form of heat, which is excess heat, which goes right into the atmosphere and is not, I repeat, is not a renewable source of energy. How about hydro? Hydro is one of my, actually, my favorite forms of energy, but there's just not enough of it. There's not enough rivers around the planet to provide us with hydroelectric energy. The only problem with hydro is that it takes a tremendous amount of infrastructure to get it going. And so you have to build dams, you have to create reservoirs. Those reservoirs, in many cases, destroy perfectly good agricultural land or cities, or basically you're destroying habitat to create this massive lake that then stores the water, and then a little bit of that water trickles down through a tube, which runs generators, which runs creates electricity. But there again, it's different than wind, and why is that? Well, number one, you have this massive amount of infrastructure and cement. How did all that cement get made? Well, you needed to heat up the components of cement, and that was a tremendous amount of heat. Where did that heat come from? Not from the electricity from the dam. It came from coal or some other source of polluting electricity. And so literally there is no free lunch here, but hydro is not a good alternative energy source. The Three Rivers Dam in China, a tremendous amount of ecological disaster because of that structure being there. So hydro, even though we like to think of it as being clean, as you build the hydro dam, it's a tremendous amount of ecological disaster. Okay, how about geothermal? Okay, here again. You're taking up stored heat that's in the earth. And by the way, I'm a big fan of geothermal heating and cooling for your house. I'm a big fan of this. But in a large-scale electrical production, geothermal is not an alternative energy. It is not a renewable energy. By pumping water down into the ground and creating steam, then have the return process. But once again, once you get that heat to the surface, it is going to take a bump on efficiency. About 70% of that is going to go right into the air. So geothermal is not. In fact, geothermal is very dangerous. When you start pumping water or live steam down into the ground, you are asking for trouble, because even though you may think that you know the conditions in the ground, you really don't. And this is, anyway, there's a number of geothermal installations were shut down over the past year because of local concerns. Would this create a volcano or earthquake? And so those are some other potential side effects. But when you get that heat, the steam, when it comes back up to the surface, then that has to be converted into electricity. And that process is, once again, due to the Carnot cycle, very inefficient, about 25% efficient. So geothermal is not an alternative energy. It's not a green energy. How about burning biomass or biofuels? In other words, making diesel, for example, out of corn. Well, you probably would have been better off just to burn the corn in the first place. There would have been fewer losses on the route to actually producing electricity. Okay, so next, looking at solar panels. Is solar an alternative source of energy? And the answer is, oddly enough, no. A lot of people think, oh, solar, that's, alternative energy. That's, I have to panel the United States with solar panels to run our electrical needs. And then people talk about batteries, etc. Solar is not a viable alternative energy source because 80% of the sunlight that hits a solar panel comes off as heat. So it's no better than burning fuels or using geothermal, etc. Any high octane source of burning material is about 70 to 80% heat production at the moment. And so cutting down a forest to put solar panels, you are going to be dumping what that forest did was absorb the sunlight and create biomass. And the solar panels are just emitting that excess heat, that other 80%, right into the atmosphere. So if you've ever been around a forest, if you walk, say, out of an open field and into the forest, it's cool. And why is the forest cool? Because it's absorbing that sunlight and creating biomass with the solar energy. And that's part of the ecosystem. Without trees and plants, we'd all be dead. So solar is not a form. And the other issue with solar is the fact that they have very limited lifetimes. And then you have to recycle the solar panels. Very costly process. And one can make calculations regarding this. The amount of ecological damage making the solar panels, how much energy do they actually produce? Do they produce enough energy to justify their fabrication and then disposing of them, these millions and millions of solar panels, after they're done? I have a picture. I don't think it's on my webpage, but it shows a picture of the three-blade wind turbine, the blades being buried in a landfill that will be forever. Those things will just not break down. And the same way with solar panels. What do you do with these solar panels when they're done? It costs more to break them apart. Then there's no profit incentive in recycling solar panels. Someone could maybe make a business out of that. There might be economic argument made for recycling solar panels, some way of eking a living out of that, but it's something that's alternative energy should be out there for a long period of time, not just 10 years to when they go to, you know. And you'll see also that solar panels, they'll put a guarantee on them for 25 years. They don't guarantee that they're going to produce the same amount of energy for 25 years. They're just guaranteed to produce some energy for 25 years, and that's true. But after 10 years, they're down to such an inefficiency that they're really not valuable anymore. How about wave action for alternative energy? Because waves are there every day, right? There again, when you it's kind of like hydro. The amount of infrastructure that you have to build to have wave action and the amount of electricity you get out of it is not commensurate with the cost at all. So wave action, although it's a nice idea, simply is not going to power countries. And then last but not least, the three-blade wind turbines, they simply don't work. They're an eyesore. They're a ecological eyesore. And they cost a lot of money to build, unbelievable amounts of steel into the towers, etc., and they have a lot of environmental problems. So three-blade wind turbines are not alternative energy. And then going full circle, coming back to nuclear, oh my goodness, it's the worst form of energy ever devised by man, because to procure the fuel for nuclear fission, the type of reactors that are out there today, if you have fusion, which is the hydrogen deuterium based, which is futuristic. Nobody has accomplished this. Or if you have something like thorium reactors, the same thing. These are high energy content fuels. You take an inert subject, a specimen of material, you change it into heat, and only about 20% or 30% of that heat actually gets converted into electricity that is useful. So any form of nuclear is not, I repeat, it is not a renewable alternative energy solution. And then what do you do with the nuclear fuel after it's spent? The biggest issue with nuclear is the fuel that results, and then the acquisition of the fuel, and then the completely corrupt international nuclear fuel market. Oh my goodness, that's a, you could write 10 volumes on that alone. Oh, okay. So at any rate, the only viable alternative renewable energy source on the planet is wind. And the way it's been utilized with three-blade wind turbines, it's just not viable. It doesn't work. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to go into the wing generator tonight. You all know about that. If you've been following me, you've heard my lectures on that. Okay, just a quick note, because at any point in time, I'm following the solar activity. The sun is very quiet, and in fact, recently has been extremely quiet. It had a little puffball of a flare on January 11th, but basically, as of right now, it's pretty much without sunspots and has been for a long period of time. We're just entering solar cycle 25. We're at the minimum. It is just coming out of the minimum between cycle 24 and 25. But the reason I'm saying this is because if something happens, if something big happens, what they're going to do is pull the power grid, and they're going to blame it on a solar flare. And that's why these web pages like spaceweather.com or space.com keep pushing the idea that solar flaring could cause some kind of earth-wide damage. And the way things are right now, it's simply not in the cards at all. So I try and keep that out there. Every few shows talk about that. Okay, the Chinese influencing the United States. I'll tell you something. The Chinese people, just like the people in the United States, are normal. They have their families. They have their loved ones. They are very hardworking. They take care of business. You know, it's the governments that are messing things up, that can't get it together. China is a very important trading partner. And one thing that's happened, I'm tuned to this because I deal with it all the time on a daily basis, but a lot of the shipping containers are in the United States, and a part of the whole shipping, international shipping cycle is that the containers have to go back and forth. So that tells you that the balance of trade, we're buying stuff from China still like crazy, but China is not buying stuff from us because people are being hampered from selling to China, and they think this is due to national pride or something. But make no mistake about it, China is an extremely important international market for agriculture, for other things, other types of products, especially chip manufacturing, other types of manufacturing that happen in the United States and get shipped abroad. China is not purchasing our stuff. And it's a big mistake. The international trade has to be about equal for this to work out. But what does it do? It opens up much bigger markets for American manufacturers. So if China is not buying goods from the United States, just the United States markets are not enough to keep these businesses going. And so the real victim of this whole thing is the American manufacturer or the American farmer, for example. Okay. But just like back in the Cold War, they used to, you know, the Americans used to think, well, the people in Russia hate us. No, they never did. They never did hate Americans. In fact, if you went over to Russia, you would be welcomed with open arms. They love to talk to foreigners. They're very welcoming people. So it's the governments that are trying to keep everybody pitted against each other. Okay, enough of that. But China is a very important international market for U.S. companies, and it should not be hindered. And the reason I can tell you this is going on, very basic reason, is the shipping containers are not going back to China. And so that causes a shortage of shipping containers in China. So they have to actually build more containers to ship their goods. Okay, just a quick note here, because you are going to be bombarded with this next topic from all directions. I'm seeing it, and I'm not sure why, but it's part of disclosure of UFO information or alien-ish information from the government, etc. Apparently, there's a part of the bill, the Recovery Act bill that was just passed by Congress, where you're supposed to get a stupid $600 check. I mean, you can't even buy a set of tires for that. What the heck? What are they thinking? What a bunch of... anyway, that's Congress. Let me tell you something. From now on, the government will not have any ability to do anything, to solve any of your problems or anything else. It'll be a giant waste. It'll be destructive. There's nothing that government, especially on a federal level, can do. So what I've suggested, Daniel Brigman and I were talking about this offline yesterday, is that the way government works in the United States is that the local government has control of the next higher level of government, and et cetera. So the county really has more control over the goings-on than the state level, and the state has more control than the federal level, except for very few specific things. Okay, so anyway, back to this idea that the government is somehow going to release information about aliens or UFOs or something. It is not going to happen. This is only a diversion for the Trekkies to keep them busy, keep them occupied, etc. But believe me, nobody, if there's real information, nobody's going to release it to anybody. Okay, now, this is very interesting. I'm going to spend a few minutes discussing this. A couple days ago, the Talk Show Live, it's like an organization, it's also a platform for talk radio. And they did a sampling of 45 million listeners and who they were, the shows that they were listening to, etc. It's like a statistical gathering effort. It was these types of statistical sampling are used for television rating, for radio show rating, for it's the same kind of process developed during World War II, statistical sampling, where you take a small sampling of something and then you can tell more general large scale, get more general large scale results from a smaller sampling. For example, if you are a manufacturer of bolts and you're going to make a run of a million bolts, you don't test every bolt. You don't measure every bolt to see if it's within standards or specifications. You only have to measure a small percentage of them. And if there are problems in the manufacturing, if there's something off, if it's not producing the bolts correctly, then your statistical sampling will show up fairly quickly and say, oops, they're too big, they're too small, the groove is not right or something, whatever it is. And so statistical sampling, if it's done correctly, is very accurate. But with a sample base of 45 million listeners, Talk Show Live went through their annual 2020 talk shows that are on the air and determined who were the top 50. And so let me quick pull this up if I can and get this page out of the way. Okay, here we are. This is actually comes from michaelsavage.com, but it's a Michael Savage is number two in the 50 top. Oh, this is the title here. The 50 most influential and most listened to streaming talk shows 2020, the year 2020. So anyway, first on the list, of course, is Rush Limbaugh. Second, Michael Savage. Three, Mark Levin. Four, Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis. Five, Sean Hannity. So, I mean, we're talking about people that are big national names. Everybody, these are household name people. Numbers seven, Glenn Beck. I'll go through a few of these. Number eight, Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And I'm going to just stop here for a minute. And then we get down to number 43, and there's the Power Hour with Daniel Brigman, which I'm a regular guest every second Wednesday of the month second hour. I'm a regular guest there. But I'm also a guest, a frequent guest on Coast to Coast AM with George. And I've been in the studio with George, with the staff, Tom and the staff. And the night I was there was in Los Angeles about 10 years ago. And I was filming the History Channel special that I did. It was a 6-part series, I believe. It was called The Apocalypse Now. And I was an expert. You know how they have the interview people and then they show some footage that they gather together. But I was in all 6 episodes. You can see that. I'm sure it's online. People see me in the grocery store and little kids go, "Mommy, there's the guy that's on the History Channel." But anyway, I was filming that, and so I was in Los Angeles at Universal Studios where the filming for the History Channel special was being done. And so I called up the studio with George, and I said, "George, I'm in town." He said, "Yeah, they were trying to get international celebrities into the studio as a way of promoting the studio. It's over in Thousand Oaks, over in Los Angeles." So anyway, I went over there, and we had some pictures taken. I believe one of those ended up in the LA Times the next day. George is there with his, we're standing side by side. George is holding up his new book, Talking to the Dead, at the time. So at any rate, the reason I'm mentioning this is that I go back with George Norrie to early 2000s. I don't know when the first show I was on with George, but prior to that, I was on Art Bell Show quite a bit. But being a guest, and of course, if you look at the limelight, the series of guests that are on these shows, I'm elbow to elbow with some pretty good company. And the same with Daniel Brigman's show, the Power Hour show. The list of guests that they have on there, like the day before me, I think on Tuesday, was David Icke. And I met David in probably around 2003. He was a speaker also at one of the UFO congresses where I was a speaker in his booth in the main auditorium. When you're not giving your talk, etc., you're at your booth promoting your products, etc. David was right across from me. So I met him at that point. But, you know, you're dealing with a, you know, somewhat exclusive circle of people here. And I know for a fact that this has happened in the past, is that I would get a call from the Coast production staff on a night when it would be ratings night. And so they wanted me on because I drew in the biggest crowd. And so that's kind of an honor to know that. So while you're neck and neck or elbow to elbow with this unbelievable international group of people who are qualified to be on that show, either Coast to Coast or Daniel's show, but then also be the person that can draw the biggest crowd. That is, something that I am very proud of. Let's put it that way. And I think people see that I'm a sincere, honest person. Also the production of work that I've done in my life. But just to be in some of these shows, and then of course Alex Jones is number. Let me just go down the list here and talk about some of these other guests here. We've got Ben Shapiro is number 9. Go down to a few more. Alex Jones, number 14. Brian Kilmeade, number 16. John B. Wells, number 17. I've been on his show quite a few times. And then you have David Knight, 19. Of course, associated with Alex Jones. And then Sebastian Gorka is number 21. Just go down the list here a bit more. The War Room with Owen Schroyer. I've been on with Owen before. And then, let's see, looking down through the list here. And right before the Power Hour at number 43 is the War Room with Steve Bannon. So you're amongst the top names, really household names at this point, and most listened to, etc. So if you're in the top 50, that is big a time. And the fact that I'm on quite a few of these shows as a guest, for me, it's an honor. Let's just put it that way. But, you know, these people work at this. These are people that are working daily, have worked an entire career, an entire lifetime to get to the point that they're at today. So I think this is a very big deal. I want to call out Daniel and, of course, Joyce Riley, who was the originator of the Power Hour. And, of course, she passed away, and Daniel's continuing her work. So it's like building on a tremendous base that she built. I was a guest with Joyce quite a bit. And when she was still alive, and then Daniel was transitioning as they were co-hosts for a while, and then she passed away, and Daniel just picked up the ball and went. So very interesting. It's, for me, something to toot your horn about, so to speak. Pound on your drum, stand on a soapbox a little bit, because that just shows the level of awareness that the public has acquired. And I have to give credit, like people like George Norrie, I don't know how he does it. The number of guests that he has on there, he has to read their books. Yes, when I'm on, he's read my books. He understands, he asks intelligent questions about my work, so he knows about me. And I'm one of thousands of guests, high-level guests that he has on there. So my hat's off to these people, or Daniel Brigman, how he has the same thing, a wide range of topics, a wide range of opinions, and how they keep track of all of this. So it's just fun and wonderful to be a part of this tremendously national, international entourage of people who are highly professional, in the sense of being on public media, and then carrying this day after day, night after night, and of course my own little radio show here that I'm sure my audience is much smaller than a lot of these shows, but still I have my faithful following, and I appreciate that. I think looking at that list and knowing that I'm associated with that list and all of the amazing people that are associated with that, and I'm in that group of people, is, for me, it's a great compliment. And my compliments off to Daniel and, of course, Alex Jones and George Norrie and all of the other people in that list. Okay, well, I've got a couple of seconds left here. Just want to remind you the sale is still on for my education package. I rebuilt the webpage so it's a little clearer. The water filters are still on sale. The wing generators are there. The all of the products that I sell, most of them are on sale. So the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.